Hello and welcome to this rather special episode of the EMG Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jonathan Sack here. And today I'm pleased to be joined by three individuals from the Voluntary Solidarity Fund, a charity accelerator, if you will, who promote social inclusion for the most marginalized, excluded, and vulnerable members of our society. So, given that this is first and foremost a health podcast, some may wonder why we're focusing on something other than health. To that, I would say, first, the World Health Organization has characterized health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. As you will hear, these amazing people are aiming to heal broadly and wonderfully. Joining us from the charity is Jean-Pierre, or JP Casey, the executive trustee of the VSF. He's also the founder of RegHedge, a pioneering firm that applies artificial intelligence techniques to extract trading insights. He's a former managing director at both JP Morgan and Edmund de Rothschild, and a visiting lecturer in economics at both the College of Europe in Bruges and an assistant professor at St. Mary's University in Twickenham in the UK. He's consulted for both the European Parliament and Commission, and in his spare time is a great lover of history, currently working on an intriguing book about the hidden symbolism of Norfolk's medieval church architecture. Sounds like a burgeoning Hollywood movie in the offing there. JP, welcome.
Good morning, Jonathan. Very good to be on the program. Thank you for welcoming me and my colleagues. And you've got a wonderful radio voice.
That's very kind of you. Alongside JP, we have Andy Keane Downs. Andy's been chief executive of the Prison Advice and Care Trust, or PACT, since 2005, winning the Longford Prize for his work with the charity in 2015. He's worked in the voluntary sector for much of his professional life, holding senior positions at Gingerbread, the National Childbirth Trust, and Centrepoint. He has a pretty valid qualification to run this prison charity, given that he was arrested as a juvenile offender at the age of 10, quite a high achiever. To quote Andy directly, people sometimes seem quite interested in the fact that a rather dull-looking middle-aged man, I'm quoting Andy, who now runs a national charity for people affected by prison, was arrested on multiple occasions as a boy, borrowing a motorbike and riding with no license, helmet, or for that matter, clue, as well as occasional drug use and other crimes and misdemeanors. And I love this one. He once broke into a Freemason's hall because he was interested to see what happened in such places. He told me they heard that they had a snooker table and a bar, which apparently turned out to be true. Andy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Jonathan. That's quite a big entry for me.
Well, you've got an intriguing background, Andy. And last, but very much not least, we have Caroline Hattersley, or Caro, who's the director of Women at the Well. It's a service dedicated to supporting women who are working to escape a life entangled in sex work. Caroline, Caro, has over 20 years' experience working nationally and internationally in a wide range of settings with vulnerable and marginalized groups. She's also a recognized expert on safeguarding, sexual exploitation, and violence, trauma, and autism. Apart from a life dedicated to incredibly noble causes and her deep love of cats, Caro is also sometimes a circus performer. And in her spare time, her act includes fire breathing and juggling balls of fire. Caro, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Jonathan. Nice to be here. Thank you.
You know, I think one of the things that strikes me, people tend to characterize someone as what they do or the major thing in their life, completely ignoring everything else, which is why I always like to, you know, paint a slightly different picture of them. So let's start with you, JP. You and I met via our mutual friend. So first, please tell us the story of the Voluntary Solidarity Fund, VSF. How did you get involved? And what can you tell us about the motivations for starting VSF?
Sure, Jonathan. Lots to address over there. So to begin with the inspiration or the background behind the Voluntary Solidarity Fund, this is a relatively recent initiative. The brainchild of a very interesting chap who's the former governor of the Central Bank of Malta and on the ECB Governing Council, so a top economist, whose intuition was that looking at Gini coefficients, which is sort of a statistic that looks at wealth inequality across countries and within countries, his realization is that there's rapidly increasing wealth inequality in the West, in developed economies, and that this isn't sustainable over the longer term, and that longer term, increasing, intensifying wealth inequality will necessarily translate into declining public health outcomes. Just to give you an example, Jonathan, right? So over the past 10 years, Mark Zuckerberg, 10 years ago, was worth $2 billion. Today, Mark Zuckerberg is worth over $100 billion. The Walton family that owned Walmart in America were worth $75 billion 10 years ago. Today, they're worth three times that. And Jeff Bezos, founder of Amazon, last year was worth $100 billion, and a year past COVID is worth twice as much, $200 billion. I don't think, we don't think this is sustainable. And so the VSF came out of this this idea from Joseph Pazici at a meeting at the Vatican, actually. This was all sort of inspired by Catholic social teaching, which is widely recognized to be an inspiration for sort of global political movements at the end of the 19th century to push for more social justice, to push for an end to child exploitation in factories, establishing a minimum wage, allowing unions to form, and to protect the overall dignity of workers and ensuring a fair distribution of returns between labor and capital. And it upholds that every single human life is endowed, is vested with infinite dignity and worth from conception to natural death. And so in a way, you could say that the underpinnings of the VSF, you know, are very closely aligned to those of the medical profession, you know, through the Hippocratic Oath, through that same ethos that human life is valuable and must be protected and defended. And so what we're trying to do here at the VSF is we're not sort of providing frontline charity support per se. We are a community of senior business executives who are looking to support a small group of charities that are providing frontline support to the most marginalized, the most excluded, the most vulnerable in our society. The very colorful CEOs and very experienced, wonderful CEOs of two of our charities on the call, I'm very, very pleased to be working with Andy and Caro and the two others. And the two others are Providence Row, a East of London charity that's over 100 years old, supporting the homeless. And the other one is the Guild of Our Lady of Good Counsel, which helps expectant mothers and new mothers in crisis.
Well, just to go back to your comment about how things are sustainable. I've said this before, but I think it bears repeating. I lived in America for many years and only recently returned to the United States. And it baffled me. I mean, Jeff Bezos and his team, bless them, you know, congratulations, you built an amazing company. But when one man has made hundreds of billions of dollars moving cardboard boxes around the world, and the country that he lives in, every night, hundreds of thousands of people go to sleep in a cardboard box. That is just, it cannot sit well. And it made me deeply, deeply uncomfortable to see the divisions. And you're right, it's unsustainable. Eventually there'll be a schism. So, and you also referenced it start as part of an initiative from the church. But, you know, I'm a nice Jewish boy from North London, and I'm a big supporter of what you guys are doing. So we're all in this together. Caro, I want to deal with something that troubles me. In Hollywood gangster lore, if you will, undesirables are retired or sent to sleep with the fishes. One never says brutally murdered. So why the gentility of sex work? Why not call it prostitution? Sex work sounds like a career one may have chosen after a genteel chat with an employment counsellor, when the truth is starkly different.
Yes, I'm glad you've raised this, actually, because I and my organisation would 100% agree with you. I think the sanitisation of language and the sort of the loss of nuance in society has led to this sort of belief that it's politically correct or somehow empowering to women to refer to prostitution as sex work, when in fact it is just pure exploitation and abuse. And so from our perspective, I think, you know, I've always said to people who question me, you know, would it be okay, exactly as you've said, if your 13-year-old daughter came home from school and said, "Daddy, I want to be a prostitute when I grow up," you know, there's no way that any parent is going to accept that as a valid career choice. Therefore, it is not work. It is trade in bodies, in sex. And as a very, very good friend of mine says, you know, if sex work is work, then does that make rape merely theft? You know, this, we have to reduce this sanitization of language. It's becoming incredibly difficult. I mean, even the phrase pimping, you know, now is seen as a good thing. You pimp your ride, you pimp your car, you know, but actually pimping is exploitation.
I'm also a firm believer in the term nothing political is correct. So yeah. Thank you for that. Carol, tell us about the group. What do you do, and how do you help women who are working as prostitutes? How do you help them?
So, so we support around 300 women each year, predominantly women who are exploited in on the streets, although we do some work with women who are engaged in brothels. Basically, what we offer is a safe space, a women-only space, where they can come, they can access basic support for any of their needs. So for those women who are on the streets, it's things like showers, food, but also they can access activities, they can access just peace and quiet and safety for a few hours a day. And what we try and do is work with the women to address both their immediate needs, which might be around housing, around modern slavery, trafficking issues, but also to work with them longer term, looking at their psychological needs, the experiences they've had of trauma, in terms of supporting them to exit from a life involved in prostitution, and to really, over the long term, to build a life that is free from exploitation.
Well, thank you very much for that. And I guess a lot of it is also about education and, you know,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. We provide training opportunities and support to access employment training and sometimes things like, you know, basic reading skills. I mean, many of our women have been, you know, our women have been failed since childhood. They've come through the care system. You know, they've dropped out of school. Most of them began their lives in prostitution before the age of 16. And so they missed out on so many of those opportunities for learning as a youngster. And so we try and put those things in place for them to help them.
I'm just inspired to mention something I saw recently, Caro, because it was a video about someone has developed a hand sign as a way of conveying to others that they're in trouble and they're frightened. And it's you may have heard of this. You hold your hand up, you fold your thumb across your palm, and then bring the four fingers down. And it's a way of letting someone know, please come and help me. I'm being held against my will or whatever. Have you come across that?
Yes, I think there are a number of initiatives like that. I mean, you know, just outside of my direct work, you know, the experience of asking for Amy in a pub, you know, that you go up to the, if you're in trouble, if you're being targeted and you're out, you know, on the town with your friends and you're in trouble, you can go to the barman and say, "Can I speak to Amy?" And then they know that you're in trouble and they can help you. So I think all of these things are really useful. I think the reality, though, is that it's not that simple. And actually, the act of asking for support for women who are trapped in, particularly in trafficking situations, is much more complicated than that. And we build trust with women over months and years before they end up telling us that they are in that kind of trouble. But anything like that is great. You know, I think it's really important to raise awareness that these things happen and that people are, you know, women particularly are vulnerable in some of these situations.
Right. So, Andy, your turn. Tell us how you became involved in this world. And, well, I mean, I know you had some prior, if you'll forgive the expression, inside experience. What sort of thing, tell us about your what inspired you to get involved, and what sort of things your charity does, PAC, to help those impacted by prison.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. Well, I didn't get inside experience in that. I never actually went to prison. I think the trick is to get your offending out of the way young enough and stay below the radar. And if you are picked up by the police, make sure it's police officers who've got some common sense, who take you home and have a good talking to you, rather than putting you into a borstal, which will tend to do more harm than good. And that was my story. And I guess the other part of my story was that I loved reading. I loved books. School for me was a place of safety and sanctuary, a place I liked. And so I did have a fairly colourful youth, but I did manage to get a higher education and trained to be a teacher, which is what I was going to do and probably will do when I grow up. But in the meantime, I've been working in adult literacy, in homelessness, in family support, and as you say, for the last 16 years in PACT, the Prison Advice and Care Trust, which has become the second love of my life after my wife. So PACT is really close to my heart because it's all about relationships, really. It's all about recognizing that when people go to prison, they don't suddenly become an offender. They don't suddenly become a different kind of human being. They're just a person who's taken the wrong road and who needs support. And for many of those people, the most powerful thing you can do is to make sure they have good, solid relationships. They've got people who are visiting them in prison, people who care about them, people are going to help them get a job, people are going to give them accommodation when they come out of prison. And most of the time, that means the person's own family. We know that if we can keep families together through a prison sentence, we can reduce their risk of reoffending by about 40%, which is the most significant single intervention you can possibly deliver. All the evidence shows keeping a family strong, provided, of course, the abuse and criminality is not within the family. So you've obviously got to be sensible about that. But 40% reduce reoffending by that amount if you keep families together. But then, of course, there are women and men in custody who don't have family. They've been in it, as Caro was saying, a lot of our service users are the same people. They've been out of care system and so on. So where they don't have a family, what's important is that they have a good positive role model, somebody to support them, whether it's a staff member or a volunteer, as a mentor. And we can, as they're released from prison, we can find them a new community, a new identity, somewhere they can belong rather than the gang or the people that they were running with before they got into jail. So that's what PACT is about. Really, we're not very visible to the wider community because most of our people are inside the prisons. We're in about 70 prisons across England and Wales. And we do family work. We do parenting education inside prisons and family casework. We also support people on around the time of release as well. So we run resettlement programs. And we also have a bunch of services which are for the children of prisoners and for their family members as well. The language they often use about their experience is that they're kind of the collateral damage of the justice system. They don't get the public sympathy of victims. They don't get the statutory support of victims. But in many, many ways, families are often the victims of their relative or their loved ones offending and of the way they're treated by the justice system itself. So we don't see them as just a means to an end. We see them as human beings who also deserve our support. And if as part of that process, we can interrupt the intergenerational cycle of offending, if we can break those patterns that we see repeated through generations in families, then we're not only doing a good job for society now, but we're doing a good job for the future as well.
Well, I think that's one of the key points of all of this. And you know, when
when I began to understand that, you know, we're all in this together, we're all on the same planet, and if anyone is suffering, then it impacts all of us directly. So even for selfish reasons, one should be considering to support you guys. Andy, years ago in my role as a young surgeon, I would often have to visit men with medical issues at Wormwood Scrubs, which for our overseas listeners is a very secure old London prison. And that environment was, to me, chilling and alien. I guess it amused the guards when I would come in. There were like these double doors, and they would close one, and I would be in like this ante room, and the guards would just sit there laughing at me. And I'd say, okay, yeah, come on, very funny. Open the door and let me in, or let me out, whichever way I was going. But the threat of prison is clearly not enough to stop people from offending. I always wondered, what about doing school trips for at-risk kids so they could see the stark reality of what a prison is, and that it's not a place to, you know, celebrate your being macho?
Well, I mean, it's a really interesting thought. It's something I looked into a number of years ago. There's been evidence on that, though, that shows that actually it's counterintuitive, but the evidence suggests that that actually does more harm than good, potentially. So these kind of programs, they're called scared straight type programs, where you take young people into prisons and they meet these people in their prison cells. They see what the conditions are like and so on. You would naturally think that would be a deterrent, but in fact, it sort of normalizes or even potentially glamorizes the prison experience. And what it seems to do is, if anything, it slightly drives up the risk of those young people offending. What does work, what the evidence does tell us, is that diversion and early intervention with children and young people, and in particular with their parents, is key. And what is really key is to keep young people, you know, naughty boys like me, like I was, to keep young people out of the justice system for as long as you possibly can. So the success in this country of youth offending teams has been phenomenal. We have seen a very significant reduction in the use of prison for young people, because what we found was that you send a young person to a young offenders institution, and the likelihood is they'll come out worse than they were when they went in. So the more we can do to keep people, young people, out of the system, the better.
Wow, very powerful. So Caro first, then Andy. You work closely with, you know, as we've heard, the prisoner and sex worker communities, who I'm sure share but also have wildly different physical and mental health challenges to contend with. Can you each talk to us about the challenges that exist for these specific patients, if you will, people, and the links between physical and mental health that you've identified? So Caro, you go first.
Yeah, I think Andy alluded to this earlier. I don't think the groups that we work with have wildly different issues, actually. I think there's similarities. For our women, what we see most often is that, as I said earlier, they've experienced a lifetime of abuse and exploitation. So typical experiences of childhood sexual abuse that then sort of go on to into adulthood, and the trauma that is carried forward. Many of them have grown up in care, come from homes that had challenges, family homes that had challenges. So what we see is large numbers of mental health issues, high levels of mental health issues with the women we support. And the real challenge for us is that because of the way that they live their lives, and because of what they're experiencing every day, they often turn to substances to kind of mitigate some of those adverse experiences. And then, of course, we find it really difficult to get them access to any kind of support, because the substance misuse team will say there's a mental health issue there, and the mental health teams will say, well, it's due to drug-induced psychosis, it's a substance misuse issue, and we can't help them. So many of our women are just stuck in this kind of limbo, unable to get any real support, which is just so difficult to address.
Andy, do you want to leap in?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Caro is describing is really familiar. For women and men, the mental illness in custody, mental illness and addiction, and as Caro was saying, you know, these are often connected. People self-medicate often to cope with trauma or with emotional psychological difficulties. We know that about a quarter of women in prison and about 15% of men in prison were receiving some form of mental health treatment in the year before they were sentenced to custody. But in spite of that, instead of being treated within mental health services, they were put in prison instead. Similar numbers report symptoms which suggest psychosis in prison again. So we see a lot of people being sentenced to prison because they've committed an offence, but that offence has been driven by a mental illness. And then we also see another group of people who are relatively well mentally when they come into prison, or there's no particular indications that they're mentally ill when they come to prison. But going to prison makes you ill. You know, it can make you go mad. So to use old-fashioned non-clinical language. So, and these mental health needs, you know, as Caro was saying, they manifest in all sorts of ways, you know, including addiction. In prisons, we see very high rates of self-harm, particularly amongst the women, and that normally, most typically, that's cutting. We see it in men as well, although it's less well reported. We see high suicide rates, and we also, of course, see violence, some of which is criminality, which is gangs, but some of which is to do with these kinds of experiences. And we also see a decline in physical self-care as well, people just neglecting their personal hygiene and not looking after themselves. So we see mental and physical decline through the prison system. And that's made worse when people feel that their sentence is not just. So in the UK, we have a thing called indeterminate sentences, which are now no longer law, but there are many men and women in prison who have no end date to their sentence, and which goes against all sense of natural justice, and that causes major issues too. And the scandal of this is that for all of those people who are mentally ill, who should be seen as patients, but instead are put in prison, there is an almost complete absence of serious mental health support within the prison system. And we know that's challenging in the community as well. Our only hope really is that the growing awareness around mental illness and mental health generally, that's been triggered by the lockdown that we've all been experiencing in society. And of course, lockdown is a bit of prison jargon that's leaked out into the community. You know, maybe that will raise awareness of what it will have been like to be locked in a prison cell.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective. Now, you've both hinted at addiction. Can we get a little bit more granular here and address addictions and how you help people in your worlds? I mean, drug and alcohol addiction is, I have to admit, I'm a surgeon. I didn't know a lot about it. And then a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, an amazing young man, my oldest friends in the world, their son, ended his life as a result of being using drugs, primarily ecstasy. And I realized, and you know, it's hit my world in other ways, and I realized I knew nothing about this space. Can you educate us?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's from our perspective, I think, you know, if you think yourself into the world of a woman who's engaged in prostitution, who is experiencing, you know, having sex with 8 to 10 individuals a day, maybe more even, I think you can absolutely understand why drugs and or alcohol are a refuge for them. In terms of our support, one of the things that we're really keen on and that we do differently to other services is that we don't actually exclude women who are presenting in a situation where they are either have consumed too much alcohol or they are high on drugs. We try and still allow them to receive support from our services in that space in the safest way we possibly can. Because at the end of the day, you know, you're basically punishing people for just trying to manage their daily life if you exclude them from services. So some of the things we do is we work with the local teams to meet women in our space rather than forcing our women to go to attend kind of clinical settings that can be quite difficult, that are often mixed gender. And also just that general patience with women and helping them to de-escalate from whatever it is they're doing. One of the things we found actually through lockdown, the lockdown experience, is that for the first time ever, many of our women were trusted to have weekly methadone prescriptions rather than having to go every day to a place to receive their methadone. And what we've seen is a larger number of women actually successfully, massively reducing their drug use through being trusted. So I think there's a real question for health professionals and others working in this field about the balance between risk and trust, and what trusting a woman or an individual who's a known substance misuser might do in terms of enabling them to tackle their own issues and take responsibility.
Andy, want to leap in?
Yeah, I think so. We're not a lot of our service users are struggling with opiate addiction and methadone users and so on. And you know, when we're supporting them as they come out of prison, you know, we're having to support them to make sure they get their scripts, as they call them, and to make sure that we're taking a kind of harm reduction approach around that. There's a huge emphasis in the criminal justice charities around multi-agency working. So we'll work alongside health professionals and addiction services. For our part, what we've seen is, I think, as Caro is describing, you know, providing accompaniment for people, providing a safe space, seeing people as human beings with aspirations and hopes and dreams and relationships that are often, you know, very tenuous and not necessarily always realistic, but seeing those human beings as people and working out with them, alongside them, what are the motivations to change? That's really key, because this is about people. It's in much of the case, many of the cases we deal with, it's as Caro describes, it's people numbing their pain and people disassociating themselves from the terrible memories or the terrible situation in which they find themselves in, and then getting into this physiological addiction. So where do you find the motivation? Many of the people we work with are actually not motivated to change for themselves, but sometimes they'll be motivated to change because they want a better life for their child. They don't want to see the shame in their mother's eyes. You know, it'll be other people that will drive their motivations in many cases. And the solidarity and the accompaniment of volunteers and charity staff who are saying, you know, we think you're worth it. You know, we're still here. And we think you're worth it. And the psychological power of that simple phrase, and I'm not sponsored by L'Oreal, I will say that now, but that is a great phrase. I'm here because you're worth it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not a very medical answer, but I think...
No, Andy, I did a podcast a while back with Dr. Robert Waldman, an amazing guy from Salt Lake City in Utah, who's just one of the most gentle and kind physicians, and he works a lot with addictions, and he really opened my eyes to a lot of it. And a lot of it, of course, is a cry for help, and it is a solve for pain. Yes, there may be associated issues like anxiety or depression or ADHD or whatever it might be, but yeah, it's an escape. And when you look at alcohol consumption during this lockdown, the civilian lockdown, and it's gone through the roof. It's understandable. So I'd like to talk about the psychology
You've mentioned multi-generational exclusion. Could you begin by defining what this is, outline the impact it can have on families, and how do individuals break that cycle? And in view of our audience here, which is largely medical, how can us physicians get involved? I'd like to start with JP.
Sure, Jonathan. I mean, I'm less qualified professionally than either Andy or Caro to answer this question, but I will offer this. Based on also everything that Andy and Caro said today, the way you get looked at as a child, the way you get treated as a child, the love and care and education that you received as a child, or the lack thereof, right, I think has got a tremendous incidence on your confidence and mental health as an adult. And ultimately, it's probably the most important variable or the most important predictive factor of whether you're going to lead a happy, productive, successful life as an adult. I would go that far, actually. And I know also from experience, not from personal experience, fortunately, but from people I know, that traumatic childhood experiences are impossibly difficult to overcome. And there's one statistic that Caro told me when I got involved with Women at the Well. It was an unbelievable statistic. She told me that Women at the Well, so of the women that come in for support, 92% get involved in prostitution before their 16th birthday. And 75% of these girls have been sexually abused as children. That means, Jonathan, that these children are being robbed of their childhood. They're being robbed of their future, and they're being robbed of their hope. I've got three little girls. I can't even begin to imagine what this must be like. It's too horrible to contemplate. And yet it's the reality of 500,000 women in this country. And we shouldn't forget a number of men as well. And in terms of, you know, criminality, Andy was telling me, you know, that the number one factor that determines whether or not, you know, you become a prisoner is sort of the family and the home circumstances. I was recently attended a wonderful event that Andy hosted with a former prisoner who said he became a convict because his daddy was a criminal. And that was his inheritance. That was his legacy. That's all he knew. How to do it at home. That's what he was taught to do, was to rob. So here at the VSF, we want to get ahead of these problems and address them as early as possible, starting even with pregnancies, for example, you know, with the Guild of Our Lady of Good Counsel, to focus our interventions at the earliest stages of childhood, even pregnancy, so that these precious lives can be nurtured in the most loving and stable environments possible, given the difficult circumstances.
Thank you very much for that, JP. Caro, Andy, do you have anything you'd like to add?
I think, JP's made reference to it. You know, what we talk about it in the sort of clinical world, we talk about the adverse childhood experiences and the impact that that will have on your later life. And I think JP's made, he's stolen my statistics, but thank you, JP. I think that the key thing around all of this for me is that what we have to understand is that, as Andy said earlier, you know, the key to solving some of these challenges and to breaking the cycles is about accompaniment, relationships, and really, you know, building those strong relationships with individuals, women, whatever, whoever you're working with. We work with women, and giving them that safe space where they can begin to think about what is it that they want, how do they want to live their lives, who are they, you know, and they can build the self-worth. And you can only do that over time, you know. And I say this, I'm not against cognitive behavioral therapy. I mean, I'm a psychotherapist by training, but you know, you can't do that in six sessions of CBT, which is pretty much what the current mental health offer is for most individuals. You know, this is a long-term relational accompaniment situation where you're looking at building a real sense of safety. You know, we know that the route, you know, Judith Herman and others talk about the route to recovery from trauma and these experiences is first and foremost about safety, and then about relationships, and then about your social network. And so, you know, we really have to try and factor that into how we deliver our services, I think, over time. And it's complicated. I completely understand that it's complicated. And I admire any medical practitioners and health professionals that do this work. But we have to challenge the systems a little bit.
Well, I think
we meet the needs.
We just have to know about this sort of stuff to ask the questions.
Yes.
I mean, one of the things that struck me when I was talking to Dr. Waldman, who I mentioned a while back, is in the United States, when you take your kid for their regular pediatric checkup, they will ask, do you use a car seat regularly? Do you have a gun in the home? Right? They'll ask those questions. They will never ask, is anyone in the home or in the immediate family have an addiction problem? Has anyone in the family got a problem with criminality? Let's ask these questions and let's raise our awareness. And Andy, do you want to, anything you'd like to add?
Well, I couldn't agree more with what's been said. I mean, I think if we could move our systems to focus on human development, on child development, on stable, nurturing families. And I'm not being prescriptive about what I mean by family. I mean, you know, healthy, nurturing, loving relationships. And if we could switch our investment in terms of health, education, social care, the justice system, upstream, we could save untold misery. And I think we could save billions, because what we do is we leave everything too late. You know, we're dealing with the symptoms rather than the causes time and time again. And that's before we get into drug policy, you know, how our drug policy in this country incentivizes adult criminal gangs to exploit children. And that's why we're seeing children dying on the streets of our major cities. You know, it's all about the drug policy. It's about our lack of courage, really, to understand as human beings what really matters to us. What do we mean by a good society? What kind of society do we want to live in? And if we don't put, you know, children and parenting and growth and nurturing and community and family, if we don't put all of that stuff first, then we're going to continue to be dealing with the symptoms and the fallout of that failure.
These are big, big problems you guys are tackling. JP, I'd like to start with you. What about the impact of COVID-19 pandemic and subsequent policy responses on the populations of the invisible, the marginalized, the excluded classes?
Gosh, it's a whole debate that you're kicking off there, Jonathan. But actually,
yeah, and you've got 1 minute to answer it.
Okay, fine. Okay, I'll try to be concise, which I'm not always very good at. But I like the term that you raised, the term you used, the invisible classes. I like that term because it rings so true. I mean, in India, they talk about, you know, in the caste system, the untouchables. But here, it's the invisibles. Because I think in our sort of materialistic, consumeristic, hedonistic, egotistic societies, we don't like to be confronted with the untouchables. So we translate them into the invisibles. We don't like to be confronted with death, with suffering, with lack of material resource. So we just exclude it from our lives very deliberately. And we try to organize our lives in such a way that we are not confronted with these sufferings. Think about it. I used to work in the city. And, you know, when you work in the city, there's always, you know, people, on the streets, asking for some change, asking for a coffee or sandwich, whatever. And I'm thinking, well, with all the lockdowns, what happens if you're a homeless person, you know, that is dependent on change to get your coffee when it's cold, or a sandwich, or to pay for a hostel on a cold night? There's no more footfall in the city. Where have all of these people gone? What human contact have they had since lockdown? How is it going to work for them in a rapidly cash-free society, right? We're migrating towards a cashless society.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, JP, but I was in China about a year and a half ago and saw that people who were panhandling, to use the American expression, begging on the streets, or like musicians who were playing something, they had a big piece of cardboard with a QR code. So you could scan it and give them some money.
Problem solved. Well, that's a good example of technical innovation that can help the invisible class. So, you know, hopefully there will be solutions. But my point is, these people have become even more invisible with the lockdown. We don't have any statistics on it. And what about the abandoned elderly, right? We might be looking after their medical outcomes, their medical needs with COVID and all that. But what incidents on their mental health have lockdowns had, where they haven't been able to have a hug or see people that they love for a year? What about prisoners who can't get out of their cell for more than an hour a day? So I think that we need to do something to address the invisible class. And lockdowns, in a way, are a mechanism that sort of cater to bourgeois, well-to-do, middle class. But we haven't talked about the impact on the bottom rung of society. I think we need to take a closer look, Jonathan.
We couldn't agree more, again, with JP. I mean, we've also got in the prison system specifically, COVID transmission has been very carefully controlled. We've not seen the numbers of deaths in prisons that were feared, but that's been at a great cost, because prisoners have been locked behind their cell doors for 23 hours a day since the 23rd of March last year. So, you know, we're awaiting a number of reports into what the effects have been on mental and physical health, on family breakdown, and on the resettlement prospects for those people. But they have been very invisible, most of those prisoners will be coming out back into society at some point. So that poses us as an organization, and I think, you know, the whole of society really, with a real challenge. You know, how do we respond to that? And I think, you know, as JP said, you know, I think what the pandemic has exposed is other diseases that existed beforehand that were underestimated and underreported. You know, the loneliness, the inequality, the homelessness, so on. And, you know, we just have to hope, we'd have to raise our voices and hope that, you know, we will all become a little bit kinder, a little bit more connected, and a little bit more aware of all of that, because, you know, we have to respond. As you say, we are all in it together, Jonathan.
Well, I'd like to move on in the interest of time and have Caro address this. Caro, how can charities like yours and communities work in tandem with governments to co-create policies and interventions that are both functional and effective?
Well, actually, it kind of crosses over with the answer I was going to give to the last question that didn't get a chance to, which is that actually at the beginning of the lockdown, there were some excellent co-created policy interventions, like you were asking where the homeless people went. So there was an initiative called Everybody In, which basically scooped up everyone who was rough sleeping and accommodated them within hotels, within youth hostels, within a whole range of settings. And in those settings were placed multidisciplinary teams that were then able to work with those individuals. You know, we were involved in that by training staff in terms of the specific needs of women, but that were then able to move to potentially work with those individuals to move them into sustainable housing. And some of those individuals had never spent a night inside since they had become homeless. So, you know, what the positives from the sort of the COVID scenario are that we have some really excellent examples of work here, of collaboration, because we were just so focused on saving lives that it didn't matter what politics you were talking about. It didn't matter whether you weren't a fan of the current incumbents, current government. It was just about saving lives. So I'm hopeful that, you know, unfortunately, the downside of COVID is we're now seeing more individuals on the streets because of lack of employment opportunities, businesses failing, et cetera. We're seeing a whole new cohort of women on the streets who aren't our typical women. So they are purely making survival choices to pay their rent because they don't have jobs and because they can't get access to benefits quickly enough. So I think it's incumbent on all of us to put aside some of our differences and focus on the individuals and the groups that we work with and say, what do they really need? And how can we all work together to deliver that support? And, you know, there's some real opportunities there. You know, internationally, there's directives coming in and suggestions and things. And I just hope, you know, I hope this narrative of Build Back Better, which I know is one of the government's three-word cliches, but I hope this narrative of Build Back Better is something we can really, you know, really grasp onto and make a massive difference for all of the people we work with.
So, JP, I've got a final question coming up where I'm going to ask you about one thing you do to improve the world. So I'll let you think about that for a second. But whilst you're doing that, JP, lots of people listen to this podcast, lots of different kind of folks, but our primary audience are doctors and other healthcare practitioners. What can they do right now to help VSF and the charities you serve?
Sure. Thanks, Jonathan. Three things very concretely. In line with the three words that comprise our name, Voluntary Solidarity Fund. Let's begin with fund. First thing is give. We've got a crowdfunding drive at the moment. Every little bit helps. It's cliched, but it's true. £5, £10, €20, $20, whatever, as you have an international audience. That's the first point. Second point is please help spread the word. You can follow us on LinkedIn, on Twitter, on Instagram, Voluntary Solidarity Fund, VSF. Look us up. Follow us on social media. Amplify the message. And number three, volunteer. All our charities are desperate for qualified volunteers. But I have a final personal plea, Jonathan, for your listeners. And that's because they're medical doctors. And I would say to all you doctors, you have already got a serious head start on all the rest of us for two reasons. The first is your work is vocational, and you're confronted with physical and mental anguish on a daily basis. That's the second reason. So with those two attributes, you have got a head start on everyone else. But I think with these two advantages, there are also two caveats that are particular challenges for medical doctors. The first, I would say, is apathy, because you're confronted with deprivation and physical and mental anguish on a day-to-day basis. And that can lead to a form of sort of blasé, you know, you've seen it all before, or seeing these patients as a technical problem to be solved, an intellectual challenge if it's a very complicated, tricky surgery, right? And there could be a temptation of sort of technical proficiency there. And the second challenge, I think, is not to play God, because technological progress is advancing very rapidly. CRISPR's technology, gene editing technology, we've seen, you know, chimeric human-animal hybrids being developed and everything else. And to ensure that medicine is really at its heart, at its core, at the service of the dignity of the human person. That would be the plea, John.
Well, thank you very much for that. And we will put links up on the EMG Health podcast website so that listeners can access them. So I promised you that I'm going to do this. I always like to ask people some version of this question. If you woke up tomorrow morning and discovered you had one wish that would come true to make the world a healthier place, what would you do? Caro, you're up.
For me, I think it would be to give people the ability and the desire to listen with compassion to whatever is being said so that they can respond and not react.
I like that. Andy?
I'd like to see investment in the family and a national parenting program be the key policy of every government.
Yeah, there are some countries that do it better than others, aren't there?
Indeed.
We can learn from them. Well, JP, your turn.
For me, Jonathan, I think it would be the rediscovery of the notion of covenant. I thank my friend Maurice Glassman, the Lord Glassman, for introducing me to the notion of covenant. And covenant implies commitment. It's the idea that we all are bound by a mutual commitment, a covenantal relationship. It's the common humanity that binds us, meaning that we've got obligations towards each other. responsibilities towards each other. And I think recognizing that, awakening to that, being aware of that on an everyday basis is the first step towards healing as a society and towards a more just and a healthier nation, not just in the medical, physical sense, but in the holistic sense of human flourishing, of human well-being and overall happiness. And that's what we call integral human development.
I love it. So to my three wonderful guests, Caro, Andy, JP, thank you so much for talking with me today about the steps we can all take to better support the health and well-being of the most marginalized individuals in society and thereby improve the quality of the society we live in. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, you know, at times like this and hearing these stories surely helps us realize that we're all in this together. As someone who lived in America for many years and saw advancing inequity, the following quote by Theodore Roosevelt resonates with me anyway. This country will not be a good place for any of us to live in unless we make it a good place for all of us to live in. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. Please go to the EMG Health Podcast website to check out more information on the Voluntary Solidarity Fund, the VSF, and explore ways that you can help. Also, please tune in again next Friday as we'll be back then on your favorite podcast app with a brand new episode and more fascinating guests. Until next week, be well, stay safe, stay curious, and be kind. Bye for now.